our special guest for today. I'm still expecting a few more guys to show up, but I really don't want to wait for them. We have at least one online with us. Okay, Rabbi Yosef Cohen, Rabbi Dr. Yosef Cohen, as you've just heard, is a rabbi and doctor, and when it comes to doctor, I guess, Tarti Mashmah, MD, PhD, lots of letters, more important than all the letters before and after Rabbi Yosef Cohen's name, as you'll see for a moment, is his this wonderful, warm personality, and his absolute dedication to what's happening here right now, and that is to see to it, to the best of his ability, that the future Rabbanim be as informed as they could possibly be, so that they can be appropriate advocates and in positions where they're not actually delivering Piskei Halacha themselves regarding monumental issues, that they can serve as effective liaisons between individuals and their doctors and postmen, whatever the case may be, and to really, you know, to be as effective as they can in various roles. And so Rabbi Cohen has consistently made himself available and has been very committed to thinking that future Rabbanim will be hopefully well positioned to serve in their capacities the way they need to. So thank you very much for joining us. Rabbi Cohen, I'm gonna be the page turner over here. So whenever you wanna switch slides, you just let me know.
All right, sounds good. So first of all, thank you very much. I have a lot of karas lev to Yeshiva and to Rothwax for letting me do this. As I do think it's important, and I have a lot of, you know, appreciation to Yeshiva for training me as well. Also to Rothwax, who not only gave me my first platform to give shiurim in his shul, but also because of your insights and because I had the recording from last year. I don't know if you'll notice, but there are comments, changes in the slideshow throughout that have been influenced by the comments they made last year. Hopefully we'll notice them here. So also, if everyone could please, I want to hear feedback. I'm interested. Please interrupt me at any time. Let me know feedback afterwards. My email's there. Feel free to contact me anytime with anything else. So the goals for today is I really want to illustrate a certain problem which I think we have, which in medical halachic literature and Shas and Chuvis and other books and Sfarim that have been written. I want to help us understand the importance of accurate medical knowledge, to understand how to obtain that information, and also possible models of how to think about these issues and how, as Rabbanim that might not necessarily also have advanced medical degrees, also be able to understand what your role could be and how you can be most effective in that position. So for the problem, there's two types of problems when you read Shas, and when you look through Shas and Chuvis, when you look through a lot of these Sfarim, a lot of these books. One of them is outdated information. It's much easier to discuss that problem because then I can just point you to a tshuva and say that it was true 50 years ago, but it's not true anymore. That's very easy. I don't have to feel uncomfortable doing that. The inaccurate information is a little bit more uncomfortable to have to discuss because then basically what I'm in effect saying is that Chilas Kavod, whichever Rav wrote the Sefer or the tshuva, but the information just wasn't right. And it's just not, he's making up psak based on metias that are incorrect.
Meaning the medical information is incorrect.
Right.
Could be wrong on the other front as well, but that's not what you're saying.
Correct. That's not what I'm trying to do now.
It could also be that the people who told the Rav the medical information, they fed it to him wrong.
Which could also be, but that's also sort of my point. Right. I don't care how the Rav got the information, got inaccurate information. I care is that the tshuva is now being written in response to something that was not accurate medically. Again, so the problem with doing this is, you don't want to sound like you're being, you know, pagavik covered, obviously, of great rabbanim. We have Ramesha on this list, Aruch HaShulchan, other people as well. But on the other hand, if I don't show you these examples, then I think that I'm not doing justice to the to illustrating this problem. So the easier one first, for the examples of outdated information. So I have a tshuva from Moshe Feinstein. Actually, next week we'll probably speak a little bit more about contraceptives, so we'll speak about this more in depth. But I have a tshuva from Moshe and Ebenezer, actually accidentally looked at, found this this morning. I was looking for something else. He's talking about IUDs. IUDs are intrauterine devices. They're a form of contraceptive. You basically put this little, it looks like a little T. I have a picture next week. We'll talk about it next week. But you put it inside the uterus, and that helps prevent birth. There are two different types of IUDs. One of them is a copper IUD. The other one is a hormonal IUD. The copper IUD causes a lot of bleeding. That is what Ramesh is referring to here in this tshuva. He talks about how it's the older type of IUD. And he says that, you know, a woman shouldn't use this IUD because it causes a lot of NIDA issues, which is true. A copper IUD causes a lot of bleeding, a lot of spotting. It can cause a lot of problems. So he says, don't use it. It's not a good form of contraceptive. Problem is, if I'm reading this, and this is the only information that I have about IUDs, that any woman that comes over to ask me a question about whether or not she should be using, what sort of contraceptive she should be using, I'm going to tell her, don't use an IUD. Ramesha clearly says, you shouldn't use IUDs, it's a bad idea. Information's old. There's new types of IUDs which don't cause these problems, are actually probably much better than some other forms of contraceptives. So you have to be very careful when you're looking at tshuva and learning medical information from the tshuva. You just have to be very careful when you're reading that information. There's another tshuva from Maisha. This one is in regards to prenatal screening. So this is interesting. You go to, this is certain communities for sure, other communities, I think depends on who they ask, but people don't do certain types of ultrasounds to prenatal testing. They don't do full body, full anatomy scans. There are just certain tests that they do not do.
They don't want to know the gender.
So the gender is a different thing. I'm not, whatever. I don't care if you don't want to know the gender. You don't want to know the gender. You know, it's up to you. But if you don't do a full prenatal scan, what's going to happen? So Ramesha wrote a tshuva where he tells you not to do them. Why? Because Ramesha, we all know, Ramesha Paskins, you're basically never allowed to do an abortion, more or less, right? So in Ramesha's worldview, the only reason why I would do an ultrasound, why I would do any form of prenatal testing, is in order to know whether or not I'm aborting. Man of Shach, I'm never going to abort, right? So there's really no point in doing this test. So according to Ramesha, don't do the testing. I point out that Ramesha here is actually not really talking about ultrasounds. He's talking about other tests. These are blood tests. But whatever, the people use this Ramesha for other examples as well. So I'm going to still blame Ramesha for this whole category, so to speak. But Ramesha tells me that, right, I'm not allowed to use, I shouldn't get, these people then say that I'm not allowed to get ultrasounds. I had a guy from, apparently his wife was pregnant in Israel, moved over to America to actually give birth, so all of his records were in Hebrew. Right, so someone put him in touch with me to translate it so the doctor will know the pertinent information, right? And I'm looking over his records. I see that he doesn't have any full anatomy scans. And this is a guy that, you know, we might see in shul, right? And it's from the same cat. Those sort of people are also not getting these scans. I heard a musmach from this yeshiva quote this Ramesha to say, maybe we should have more emuna, maybe we shouldn't get these scans. The problem with all that is, right, Ramesha is binary option, abort or not abort. We have a lot more shades of gray. A, for certain defects, I can do in utero surgeries. There are surgeries I can fix while the woman is still pregnant, right? And sometimes the results are actually better when I do it that way. And so that's one reason why I should get an ultrasound. Another reason, and okay, fine, whatever, that's rare. You want to tell me right? Don't say though, fine, I can handle that. But there's other situations where if I don't know that there's a defect, I don't know there's something wrong, I don't know to A, give birth in a hospital with a good NICU team, with a neonatologist available and ready to receive this baby, and B, even when I go to a hospital that has a NICU, those physicians now don't know to be standing there, right? As soon as the woman gives birth, the NICU team can be ready in order to help save the baby's life. You wouldn't have that if you didn't do the ultrasound before. You didn't know that there was potentially something wrong. No OB-GYN wants to go into a delivery not knowing what they're getting themselves into, right? And there's a good reason for that. They want to make sure everyone stays safe. There's very good reasons to do these testing. And again, when I'm sure with this tshuva, it could be that in a Hanami, at his time, that wasn't something that could have been done. But now we do have.
Legally, will hospitals allow you to give birth without doing any scans? Or obviously you come in and she's
giving
birth and fine, but like a stunt person...
I think you can refuse whatever you want.
Refuse them and...
If a woman's about to give birth, I'm going to help her. Like,
So
the next category that we have is inaccurate information. We can just skip to the slide after that. So there's a couple of different examples of this. One is, this is not necessarily all medical, just to keep things a little bit more interesting and not just talk about medicine, but if you read some of the Sfarim about weight, about volume, they're talking about the Shir Kebetza or Shir Kezayis, right, which is a volume measure, not a weight measure. And when they're talking about it, they give you a measurement in weight. right? If you know the difference between the two, that's why I have the scale on the slide, right? It's a pound of feathers and a pound of iron, or lead, I think that is, weigh the same exact amount, right? This is the trick question. What's weighs more, a pound of leather, a pound of feathers? Obviously, it's the same. It's a pound. But if I, what is volume? Volume is how much that item will then displace water. How much water will it displace, right? So feathers don't really displace any water. They have very low density. Lead has a very high density. You put it in water, it will displace a lot more water. So when you're talking about volume measures, again, you have to be careful that you don't give the measurement in grams. And if you do give a measurement in grams, or you know whatever the pounds or whatever American version you want to switch it to, that you only do that when you're talking about one specific item. You can't then use that to infer to something else. That's one example. Electricity, Aruch HaShulchan famously says, right, that electricity is like fire in the walls. Although to Aruch HaShulchan's credit, he does say, but, you know, I don't really know how this works. But fine, but he refers to electricity as a fire. And then there are still Paiskim nowadays that say, maybe by Yontif you're allowed to use electricity because I'm allowed to manipulate fire on Yontif, right? So again, it's interesting. It's just not how the Metzius of electricity works. It's not, there's no fire in our walls. It's electrical current. It's different. There's another Rav Meisha. This,
Yeah. Why can't we say that an electrical current is fire in the wall? I don't understand.
Because they're thinking about it as literal fire. If you're thinking about what electricity is, then it's just electrons moving around. What do you mean? What do you? Let me rephrase the question. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Rav Chaim Meiser made Abdullah on a light bulb, right?
That's different, right?
Because he held that the electricity
is not correct. That's not correct.
That's not fire.
The filament was on fire. It's not the electricity. The reason he made a bracha on a light bulb is because there was a glowing piece of metal that if you would touch paper to it, it would ignite. That's the fire. It wasn't the electric current that was eating it. Well, let's not get stuck on this.
Yeah.
I always assumed electricity was fire. That's funny. Yeah.
So the next, we have another Amisha. This one is unfortunately just based on information, it's not true. Amisha here is talking about whether or not a woman that married someone, she and her husband are both carriers for Tay-Sachs, right? Autosomal recessive disease, right? Ashkenazi disease. Yeah? And Amisha is talking about whether or not this woman can go on contraceptives. He said, why is she going on contraceptives for? Just have her have a better diet, exercise a little bit, she'll get healthier, and then she can get pregnant and have a kid, and there won't be any problem. The reason why I include the diagram on the left there is just to point out that autosomal recessive inheritance pattern, it's completely irrelevant how healthy or unhealthy the woman or the man are. It doesn't matter. The point is, it's not how genes work, right? Genes are, if you're autosomal recessive disease, there's a 25% chance that you will have a kid with Tay-Sachs. It's, you know, the Eitza doesn't really help with the problem that he's discussing.
I mean, later she would show that Rav Moshe came around to understand that, but this was probably just based on, could this have been based on science of the day or no?
I don't.
Toshin Yud Beis, really.
It's a long time ago. It could be. It's interesting that you say that because the other tshuva that I'd shown before,
yeah.
The one about the IUD, originally when he was talking, when you go earlier, the one about prenatal testing, the one over there, it's unclear what he's talking about. But he mentions a disease that affects 25% of people. So I assume in that tshuva he's talking about Tay-Sachs.
Yeah.
And then in which case it could be change his mind, which mechus, it could very well be. But again, my point is if you're just looking at isolated tshuvas, then you might end up with an inaccurate picture.
What about something like polycystic ovary syndrome? In that case, diet's a huge factor.
That's
not what he's talking about.
But that's not what I'm talking about. Sometimes it is true, yeah. But that's, Ramesha here is clearly talking about Tay-Sachs, right? Next slide. This one is going to, I think everyone can agree with me at least, hopefully. This one was it was an article written in, I don't know if I remember this, before COVID there were other epidemics, and a year before there was a measles epidemic, one in New York City. In the middle of this, they published this pamphlet about whether or not you have to get vaccinated, and somebody published in this journal the issur to get vaccinated, and on his list of issurim of why you shouldn't get vaccinated, or at least why schools are, it's usur for a school to say someone who doesn't get the vaccine can't come to the school. In the middle of this, part of the argument is, in addition to the fact that the vaccine is dangerous, which it is not, but in addition to that, he also says, well, the chances of getting measles are very low. I just point you to this graph on the left here, which is the replication rate of the virus. If you look, this is during in New York City in certain populations, you could see that that is accurate. When most people are vaccinated, that if I do not get vaccinated, the chances of me getting measles is very, very low. But if I'm in a community that's a close-knit community and there is a percentage of people, it doesn't have to be that significant of a percentage, and there's a percentage of people that do not get vaccinated, the chances of getting it increase exponentially, very, very quickly. So that's another, it's a measles example. There's another example you want to...
No, I'm good.
Oh, okay.
this is from Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky that...
Yes.
So wait, what did Reb Shmuel say?
It's in the slideshow.
I know.
He says you shouldn't get, he said don't get vaccinated. The school can't force people that do not get vaccinated to come, and he says it's a good idea to not get vaccinated. It's in the PowerPoint you'll get later, I guess.
Yeah, right? I mean, that's
it's not a, well, it's not a chiddush.
Yeah, it's pretty well known. Yeah.
Vaccines are a big deal because vaccines, for some reason, cause a lot of controversy. It's still, who knows why. But HPV vaccines was also something, by the way, this slide is very much based on the comments that you gave me last year.
This is a new vaccine. HPV is relatively new. Right?
Relatively new, that is true. It's not like the other vaccines. But let's first talk, what is HPV? HPV is this virus. It's considered a sexually transmitted infection. It's a virus, right? You can get it from other things, not just directly from sex. But it's an a virus that can develop into cervical cancer. Probably the reason why people get cervical cancers. It is incredibly common in people that were sexually active at one point. It is a very common virus. There is a vaccine to help to prevent that virus from being effective. That vaccine is most effective in kids that are pre-teens usually, around 11 to 14, whatever it is. Younger children are pre-teens usually, early teens, the best time to give this vaccine. In Israel, the way you get vaccinated, as opposed to in America, it's a great system, is it's part of the school system. At school, instead of having to go to a pediatrician so the parents have to remember to take their kids, it's just in school. They get everybody vaccinated all at once. Very efficient. What happened was, in the religious schools, they wanted to give them the HPV vaccine. These rabbanim heard that their kids were getting HPV vaccines. This is a vaccine for people that are it's primarily meant for people that are sexually active to prevent STDs. And they were not very happy about it, to say the least. They published a whole response about this, how it's absolutely terrible that these kids get this vaccine. We refuse to allow it in our schools. So there's a couple of interesting things you could think about by making that statement. One is, it's not actually accurate. HPV, you can get outside of sexual relations, so it's not necessarily true. B, if, let's say, someone becomes a Baal Tshuva at one point in their life, right? And then me, who went to a religious school, wants to now marry that person. For all I know, beforehand, they were sexually active, right? I'm now at risk for maybe HPV, and I didn't get this vaccine that could have helped. I'm potentially limiting the amount of partners that I can have. The third one, and this is a public policy issue, so I'm not going to comment on it, but I did include it in the slideshow because Brad Rothfax made the comment last year, so I'm going to include it. And that is that just because we're talking about people that aren't necessarily, that aren't religious, when we say people are sexually active are people that are not from, that's not necessarily an accurate statement. There are people that are Shemesh Shabbos that do everything else, but also, whatever, Yetzirah is Yetzirah, right? And they do other things as well. And we're basically, in effect, saying that if you're going to do something which is not a pialacha, we say that you should now be at risk for getting this cancer. It sounds like a very, a little bit of a sadistic statement to make. Yes. So next slide. So
did anybody present those arguments to those rabbis?
I have absolutely no idea.
It wasn't you.
We're gonna do another. There's another piece written about HPV vaccine at the end of the slideshow, and that one I did have input in. I'll show it at the end. But this was not. What do they care what I have to say? No, but this also gets published. This is in Israel, but it also gets published in Hamodia. I don't really care what the journalist has to say, but the journalist in Hamodia publishes an article. He's not presenting himself as a rabbi, not as a doctor. I'm not exactly sure why he's talking about whether or not people should get HPV vaccines. And this is just in Hamodia. He publishes an article, this is in 2019, about how people shouldn't be getting, religious people shouldn't be getting the HPV vaccine. The only reason why I quote this, I, again, couldn't really care less what he's publishing, but it's just a very classic argument. A, he talks about how he's not an anti-vaxxer because he got vaccinated. This is just like, it's just the model for, I guess, before COVID, and just the model of everybody that ever talks about anti-vaccine. They use the exact same strategy. He's not an anti-vaxxer. He got vaccinated. His kids got vaccinated. He quotes questionable data. He generalizes things without providing any specifics. And then he includes some sort of religious argument about why he's right. It's just whatever. This is not a very, it's not good public policy from a medical perspective, to say the least. This, again, I'm just trying to illustrate the issue and why that there actually is a problem. And there's a reason why I'm speaking about this, and I'm not hopefully not wasting your time. And to that, I think that, and again, Rabbi Rothfuss, this is a slide inspired by you as well.
Rabbis?
Oh, that's not good. Yes. So there are two types of rabbis. Hopefully, I think only one rabbis. There are two types of rabbis, right? So we have to discuss how, obviously, the people that are responding to serious novel issues, like Rav Schechter during COVID-19, Rav Willig, certain issues, obviously, they need to be able to get good, accurate medical information, up-to-date medical information. These things are very complicated. They're not basic things that everybody necessarily knows. You need to go to specific specialists. There's a lot more, a much higher standard of what the information that they need to get. However, and Rabbi, I think you sort of said this in your introduction just now as well, is there's also, the Rav of the Shul who's answering basic halachic questions. But if you're not aware of certain terminology, of certain concepts, it's very hard for you to be effective in your post. So these are things that would potentially be useful to any Rav, not necessarily to know how to do them, but to be aware that there exists a way to get good medical information. And even if, they're not going to answer a question, let's say about one of their Baal Batim, Rahman has a relative on a ventilator talking about brain death issue, whatever it is, even if you're not the one who's going to pass him that question, but your responsibility, you're going to be involved in this discussion to some degree, right? So you want to be able to at least recognize the issues, be able to understand what they're talking about, be able to understand whether or not the information that you're getting from people is accurate information or not. So, which basically then leads us to the question, how do we actually obtain medical data? So before we talk about how to obtain medical data, one more slide. We should always so point out that medical data is not necessarily always relevant. For example, we know that a baby with tzehevet, right, a baby that's suffering from jaundice, does not get a mila, right? The mo'el will look, they'll determine whether or not he gets, they'll get a mila or not. Now, I think most mo'elim just trust a pediatrician, but there are mo'elim that have their misera about whether or not they'll give a bris to this kid. Now, I can tell you medically that most children, most babies, that are, out of the hospital, they check the bilirubin level. The reason why they're yellow is called physiological jaundice. It's totally healthy. It's totally normal. It's fine. There's no medical reason why they cannot get a bris, which means that from a medical perspective, what's happening now is we're being mevatel a mitzvah say of doing the bris on the eighth day because of this misera, this halachic concept, which is fine. It just means that this is not, the medical knowledge is completely irrelevant to this discussion, right? For this baby, the misera that we're not going to give a kid a mila because they're yellow. So fine, besela gamo. Don't do the mila, but don't go the other way. Don't tell me you're going to do something because of your misera, because that will cause, and I know medically that that's dangerous. As long as I know medically it's not dangerous, then you could tell me, halachically, I have a reason not to do this.
I disagree with the misera, because the baby is healthy, right? You have a mitzvah there, right? So just because you have a minhag, it says the baby's yellow, you don't feel a bris. It's totally crazy. And I know I live wrong.
So I don't think you disagree with Mish. It's fine. I'm just quoting those mo'elim that are doing.
I'm saying if you're willing to acquiesce to them not to do the mila, mm-hmm. right? Then they're going to go back and say, oh, we can do a mila now when really we should.
Oh, you think this is setting a dangerous precedent?
Yes.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
The exact opposite. Because of the fact that
medical is so nuanced, medicine and is always nuanced. You should always be asking the medical shayla to begin with. Like, once it's medically cleared, you can figure out whether or not your masora lets you do it or not.
Who feel that they, they're in charge, right? And the parents, they go to the moel and they go to a doctor, depending on which community you're in. The doctor will say she never bris, and we'll say sure, and then you have problems afterwards.
I've never heard of a moel that would do something like that, so I just don't know. I've never heard of a mole that would do that.
You should go to a mole that does that, specifically.
But the Masorah that they have of not giving a bris when there's physical jaundice, that's probably because they had no way of differentiating between the yellow that would make the babies at peril, at risk, and the one that wouldn't.
I don't want to get into a lot of discussion about this.
But I'm saying
it could very well be, but then you're giving time into things, and then whether or not we're going to change what we've always done. Again, I would tell you back, from the halachic perspective, I'll just say back, well, I have a Messiah that tells me that if the baby's yelled, that means it's dangerous. Can you, the physician, tell me, the moyel, that there's no risk whatsoever to this baby if I do a bris? If you as a doctor say there's absolutely no risk to this baby if you do the bris, guaranteed, 100% positive, I will never ask you another medical question. You have no idea. For all you know, there's something else could go wrong. Who knows? Right? From halachically, again, medically, I know you're right. Right? Halachically, I'll say, well, the fact that there was other complication, that was because I have this mister that was yellow. Again,
I'm saying they couldn't differentiate.
Yeah. So the next thing is we want to when we're talking about how to analyze these facts, we have to think about three different things, and that is we have to know who to ask, we have to know what to ask, and we have to confirm the information that we are given. So first, just to be clear, all physicians receive a standardized medical education, right? All doctors in third year medical school learn internal medicine. They have a couple of weeks of pediatrics, OBGYN, surgery, neurology, psychiatry, and family medicine. I think some medical schools might also require emergency medicine, but that's basically the standardized education, right? So they're all learning. They spend a few weeks in each rotation, so they all have a basic concepts of all these fields. However, they do not spend time in other specialties, and there are a lot of specialties. So, for example, if you go over to any physician anywhere and you ask them a question about about OBGYN, for example, some sort of obstetrics question, right, they hopefully will have at least a limited knowledge. Again, you shouldn't necessarily ask them. We'll talk about that in a second. But they will have at least limited knowledge about that subject. They'll probably have more knowledge than you will because they spent a lot of time studying it. However, if you ask them a question, for example, can someone who has a cochlear implant hear Megillah, right? If someone has a hearing aid, hear Megillah, and you're trying to figure out the scientific information, they probably know as much about hearing aid as you do, because you never come across it in medical school. It's not really something that's part of the core curriculum. Maybe a couple of questions here and there on a boards test, but it's not actually part of the standardized curriculum. There's no reason to think that they would know more than you. I mean, hopefully, they'll, A, be able to honestly identify subjects that they do or do not know, and B, hopefully have the know-how to actually be able to research it and be able to give you a more accurate answer, but there's no reason to assume that they know about that any more than you do. So as far as knowing who to ask, you should be aware also that physicians also specialize. You have to ask the appropriate physician. The easiest way to ascertain this is just basically ask the doctor, is this your area of expertise, is it not? Because again, doctors, like all people, also have egos, right? And if you ask me a question, I might give you an answer, even though it's not necessarily what I am an expert in. Hopefully, he won't do that, but for all you know, they will, right? So ask them, is this your area of expertise? And also, know the difference when you do have to do that and when you do not, right? Some questions are very specialized, and you need to ask someone who knows this field very, very, very well and has been up to date and current in that field very well. There are other things which are just basic. If you're not sure if your patient on oxygen means that he's on a cannula, he just has this little tube in his nose, or he's actually on a ventilator, right? That you could probably ask anybody what the difference between those two things are. Hopefully, anyone that went to medical school can answer that very basic question, right? So just also being aware of what's considered complicated and what's basic is also good to know. Another thing is, and I think we all succumb to this sometime, is that a lot of times the Yerei Shamayim, the physician in your shul, the one that you've been family friends with for the last 20 years, right? They might not necessarily be a specialist in that field. And just because they're happy to give you answers, they're available, doesn't necessarily mean that they're the ones that you should be asking your questions to. They might help guide you how to formulate your question or who to address the question to, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're the ones that you should be asking the question to. a good way in general to know whether or not a physician is up to date in a given topic is A, ask them if that's their specialty, and B, also find out, do they have an academic affiliation? If they're private practice, they don't necessarily have to always be up to date. If they have an academic affiliation, they're working in a university, even better if they're doing research, then these are people that have to know this information very, very, very well, and usually they're very up to date. So also being aware of, again, the different types of physicians, the different types of doctors can also help you get a better answer. I just have a Tshuva of Ramesha saying that if you have an option, this is a medical question, not a halachic question, but if you have the option between going to the Yerush Shemayim and between going to the best physician available, so go to the better doctor. Don't go, it's nice that Yerush Shemayim, but going to the, I don't think this has to be said, but it's a Tshuva, so I quoted it. There's the next slide. So I just want to illustrate this point as well. So is it, I don't know if everyone was holding during all the different shadows that came up during COVID, but one of the questions was the question of splitting ventilators. What happened was they were afraid there weren't going to be enough resources, we're not going to have enough ventilators, so what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to take two patients and put them on a single ventilator. So this is the picture of what, again, these aren't real people, these are, because I don't think anyone ever actually used this, but this was a fear, so they were preparing this protocol of how exactly to do this. Now, if you learned it on the next slide, so this is Rav Schechter's first tshuva on that. Now, I happen to know who the special was that spoke to Rav Schechter, and I know when he spoke to Rav Schechter, so I know the difference. And Rav Schechter, I think, had three versions of this tshuva. The first version of this tshuva, when you read it carefully, you'll notice, A, the person who was the doctor that was giving Rav Schechter the information, A, seemed to think that they had already started using it, which they hadn't. He also seemed to think that the question was, when I have two patients arrive to the emergency room, can I put both of them on the ventilator, right? Two people come in, no one's on a ventilator, everybody needs to be on one, can I put them both on? Or better yet, the question was, I know someone, statistically, someone else will come in 5 minutes that will need the ventilator. Once I put the first one on, can I add the second one onto this ventilator? The next version of this, the next slide, speaking to the specialist that was actually dealing with this issue, you notice that in this tshuva, the issue is identified more precisely. What happened was that, first of all, this specialist, we got very lucky because, A, the specialist is a graduate of our yeshiva, so he happens to be holding and learning, is able to identify issues and made himself available to everybody that needed him. I think Rav Schechter, Rav Willig, and Rav Bleich all spoke to him at different times. And what also is the two hospitals, the two institutions that were debating how to actually do this protocol were Columbia and Harvard. And he had just graduated from Columbia residency and went to Harvard for fellowship. So he had the protocols for both. He was able to send us everything. It was very convenient. But what happened was, after he speaking to the ventilator, he realized the issue actually was that these two patients were two patients. They each one had their own ventilator, because you can't take two people randomly and put them on the same ventilator. They have to have the same requirements on each one. So each one had to get their own ventilator. Then I'd have to take one of them off. They're both in an ideal situation. Take both of them off from their ideal situation and now have them share a ventilator. Are you allowed to do that? It's a fundamentally different question, right? It's not lichatchila, I'm putting two people in a bidyevet situation. It's lichatchila, they had a good situation, and now I'm putting them in a bidyevet situation. It's a fundamentally different question. So also, it's very important that we also have to know what to ask, not just who to ask. I think we've exhausted that ad nauseum about how important it is to actually speak to people who know the field. Yeah,
I may
interrupt you because I have a lot of things to say. I may ask you to hold to the end, but you
just
could...
wanted to know the name of that doctor.
Oh, maybe I'll tell you later. I'm recording. I don't know if he wants it recorded. So we also want to know what to ask. So there are really three different things we have to think about. One is that you want to ask specific questions. For example, if you go over to a physician and you ask them, you have a woman right before Yom Kippur, she wants to know whether or not she could, whether or not she has to fast. So you go over to the physician and say, if this pregnant woman fasts, you know that we have a very high threshold for how much of a rave we need when it comes to sakana. So you say, if this pregnant woman fasts, can you guarantee me that there will be no danger? Again, no respectable physician speaks in absolutes, right? We could say, we assume there shouldn't be any issue because she's not at higher risk than anybody else in the same situation. As Ryan Rothbach pointed out last year, you should also ask the opposite version of that question, which is, if this doctor says this woman should definitely not fast, you should also ask, do you think any pregnant woman should fast? Because maybe this person is just hypervigilant and never thinks any pregnant woman should fast. He doesn't have any data backing him up, but whatever, it's what they happen to think. you have to be aware that when you're asking questions, you have to ask specific questions. You also want to make sure that you're aware that you want to ask for sources. You want to make sure that when you're getting information, sometimes it's not relevant. If it's a basic medical concept, then there's no reason why you need some papers or some journal articles to back you up. But otherwise, you'd want to have some sort of information that shows, that illustrates that what the physician's telling you is actually accurate. The other thing which is also very important, this is about asking specific questions, is that you should also make sure it's also important to know appropriate terminology. So for example, right, if a Baal Bos comes over to you and says, listen, I have some milk, I had some meat, they accidentally got mixed up, I don't know what to do, what do you think I should do? You're going to answer that person very differently than the Baal Bos that goes over to you and says, I have a kli, not bar not, that Dabar Chare fell into it. Right, this guy, the second guy, is obviously someone who's holding, someone who knows something about learning. The person who's asking you a more specific question, in general, will get a much better response. Same thing is true the other way around. When you are asking a rabbi, a doctor, a question, as the Rav, if you are able to ask questions with appropriate terminology, you're able to get a much better response. And the physician also knows what you're asking them, because you are asking an accurate question. These things are also very important. I should tell you that the whole concept of focusing just on terminology was something that Rebbeich thought that we should do. I think I wrote last time. We also discussed this, but terminology is incredibly important. It also helps you sound more professional. People respond to people that sound professional. You sound better. And so people take you more seriously. This also has, again, I ended up in this meeting between Rav Asher Weiss and this woman in Israel who is in charge of a lab that was trying to grow stem cell meat. You're familiar, they grow meat out of cells, and this way you don't have to shecht all these cows. So the question was whether or not this is, what's the right way to do this so it'll be kosher. The problem is that when you grow these cells, you grow them in a medium that's treif. Right? These cells grow in basically blood. Right? So that's the first issue. Before you get to anything else, is this parv, is this not parv, can you eat pork? The first question is whether or not you can even grow the cell and then be able to eat it. Because if it's growing in blood, and you need the blood, and it won't grow without the blood, it's the Davar Maimed, right? So you end up with an issue. So Rav Asher Weiss asked her this question. She goes, the only reason why I grow them in blood is because I want to keep my cells happy. If I don't have to keep my cells, if otherwise, in theory, I could do it without the blood, but my cells will be much happier when they're growing in the blood. And if you ever worked in a molecular biology lab, keeping cells happy is like the most important thing. That's what you want. If your cells aren't happy, you're having a terrible day. It's very, very hard to grow. True, in theory, you could do it without. But if your cells aren't happy, it's very difficult to get the results that you want. Maybe that changes the parameter of the question. It's unclear. But again, you have to make sure that you're speaking the same language. It's very important. Next slide. And then we also want to talk about the final thing, to actually analyze the sources that you get. And that is, I think it's important to understand the process, the part of the idea of reading medical journals, in order to be able to appreciate this. So the first thing you want to think about is the year that a publication is published, right? When we learn, in general, the earlier source we have, the better. If I have a Rishon, right? Why would I quote an Achron if I have a Rishon? Right? The problem is, in medicine, obviously, things are changing all the time. I want to have the most up-to-date information possible. If I'm quoting something that's very old, if I quote something that's 100 years old, it might not necessarily be accurate anymore. Real problem with medicine is if I quote something that's 5 years old, that might also not be accurate anymore, but, you know, we'll leave that aside. You also want to know what's the impact factor of the journal it was published in, right? There are some journals that are prestigious journals and that are much more significant if something gets published there versus some other place. Also, you want to know is how many people are included in the study. It's very hard if it's just a case study, just one person is in the study. It's very hard to draw any conclusions from there. And you also want to make sure that you understand exactly what was studied, right? Because this is sort of like the difference between learning Rishonim versus learning Mishnah Berurah, right? When you're learning Rishonim, we're learning Halacha, you know, Kedasa Kedin, like we do, hopefully, right? Then what you're trying to do is you're trying to establish principles. I learned this, and from here I can infer X, Y, and Z, right? The problem with the guy who's just learning Mishnah Berurah is that he only really knows what to tell you about that exact case. If he doesn't know how that Halacha was formulated, it's very hard to apply it anywhere else. research articles are written like a Mishnah Berura. They're written for specific cases. I studied a very specific population. I studied smicha students in YU between the years of 2018 and 2020, and I cannot necessarily infer my findings from that population to Stern girls from the same time period, right? I may be able to deduce that maybe they're the same because, you know, they come from the same families, but there's no reason why I can necessarily make that conclusion. I need to have another study to prove that point. It's also important to know that when you're actually reading science, not in scientific journals, it often gets misrepresented. So this is just a silly example that I just, when I Googled science misrepresented in mass media, this is what came up. The headline in all these in a bunch of articles was smelling flatulence can help you live longer. Why? What happened? These poor serious scientists in a research lab were studying mitochondria. Right? And they discovered that there's a certain chemical in mitochondria that might help produce energy in cells. So that's very boring, and no one's really interested in reading about that. But what people are interested in, apparently that chemical was also found in gas. So the article was, passing gas, smelling gas, it can help you live longer. It's also sometimes, this is obviously a silly example, but they also have serious consequences, that if you, this is a study looking at a link between gun possession and gun assault. The question was whether or not owning a gun prevents me from getting attacked by someone with a gun. So obviously two different people quote this study. One of them, again, you can guess which political spectrum everybody here is. One of them says guns will never offer protection, which is, again, not something that was studied. The question was only whether or not owning a gun can potentially mean that getting assaulted by a gun is more or less likely. And the other one decided that gun ownership is a disease, which is, again, not exactly what the study was looking at. They weren't analyzing whether or not gun ownership is a disease. They were thinking about whether or not gun ownership is associated with something else, right? There's a difference when you're looking at epidemiologically related. But the question is, when you're looking at epidemiology, you don't want to confuse cause and effect. The disease is the effect, not the cause. This was a question, so they're looking at it as effect, not as cause. They're misrepresenting the statistics of this paper. There's also, this happened a lot during COVID. Again, COVID really highlights a lot of the things that I want to say in this chabura, so it was very helpful. But there's also something called preprint articles. There are articles that when articles get published in a journal, peer-reviewed journals, there are people that analyze them, people that send feedback, people that double-check what you did, hopefully. And you have a lot of back and forth to make sure that accurate information is being published. Preprint articles are articles that are published on this website. It's like Wikipedia. Anyone can pretty much publish anything they want on this website. And what happens is you can also look like real papers so people can quote them. Sometimes they are serious papers and they are seriously quoted. The CDC quotes articles from preprint servers. The problem is that you can, again, publish just about whatever you want. So, for example, there was one article published on preprint server that beer consumption is correlated with a lower death rate of coronavirus, which means you may reach the conclusion based on this study that if you drink a lot of beer, or I don't know if you have to, it's only when you get COVID or before you get COVID, I'm not exactly sure what they analyzed, but you would reach the conclusion that beer can somehow serve as a therapy for COVID infection. Which
is that only Corona beer?
I'm not sure. It wasn't clear. It wasn't clear from the study. These are obviously important follow-up studies that have to be done.
Scientists, I'm happy to volunteer.
So again, these are some of the issues with being aware of where your articles are coming from. I also want to make a point about statistics in halacha and in medicine. It's next slide, please. Right, when we talk in halacha, right, when we talk about whether or not rive, you want to know batel b'shishim, I'm just giving you percentages, right? So for rive, that's 51%, right? If I'm talking about batel b'shishim, that's 1.7%. Echad be'alef, that's 0.1%, right? Agree with me on the numbers? Let's translate that into practical terms. If I am speaking to a doctor about his fatality rate in his hospital, let's say in Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, there's approximately 300 babies born a week, right? So if I say I want to know that rive babies make it out of Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, here is the difference when I speak halachically and when I speak medically. Halachically, that would mean if I say there's
51 babies.
So that means 153 babies are dead die every week in the hospital if I use rife. If I use batel b'shishim, that means 5 babies or so die in the hospital every week. Echad be'alef is a little better, only 0.3 deaths per week. I probably have to wait about a month before I end up with an actual fatality rate. again, you want to be, these are obviously unacceptable terms for medicine. You're not going to, you, when you ask someone, you're thinking halachically, and you're asking someone medical statistics, you want to be aware of what that practically actually means, right? These are two totally different things. You can't accept a echad b'shishim or something like that in medical terms. That'll be terrible, right? So again, these are things that you just have to be careful of. So this right here, PubMed, is the gold mine of finding good medical information, right? This is a database. It's available for anyone can use it. It's and you can search to find articles. The only problem with this, anyone can use it. The only problem is not every article is available for free to anyone. So if you have an academic affiliation, most university hospitals will pay for it. So most doctors that work are affiliated with some hospital probably have access to most of these journals. But otherwise, if you just, I think YU has access to some through REITs. Einstein obviously has access to everything. But you can't necessarily access all the actual articles, but you can usually at least get the abstract, which is usually good enough. You'll get the basic information from the paper. So this is how you find them. It's pubmed.gov. Now, while you're looking through this, one of the things you want to check is the impact factor. Impact factor, that's the next slide. It's the average number of article citations in the last 2 years. The higher impact factor you have, the more impressive of a journal it is. You can always find out the impact factor of any journal. Just Google the journal name, impact factor, and it will tell you what it is. But you could see that, you know, these are some of the leading New England Journal of Medicine is top three in the world, right? These are some of the best publications in the world. You can easily tell whether or not this thing is considered good. Now, I want to actually give you just an example so you can try to do this for yourself. I don't know if you can read this, but this is an article. What do you think? Is this a good article or not a good article? And what's your critique of using this to learn anything? If you can't read, I'll just move on. You just very quickly before reading anything,
it's
just
one person. It's a one person study.
Exactly. A, it's a case study. That's one issue. What else do you have? And that's not necessarily so bad. But you're right. Some of the 1927 is obviously a problem. This thing's about 100 years old. And also, just you not necessarily would know this, but this this journal. Oh, sorry. Can you
the
go
patient,
one over the slide, please?
One patient?
Yeah, it's one woman. It's a case study. It's not a review article. It's not a full trial.
Okay.
And also, this journal, if you actually try to find its impact factor, it doesn't. I don't even think it has an impact factor. Okay, so it's a random journal, middle of nowhere.
1927.
It's about 100 years old, and this is a case study. So someone gives you something like this, you know, maybe wait a second. Maybe I should take this with a grain of salt. Maybe this is not necessarily just because he provided me a piece of paper that looked scientific, doesn't necessarily mean it's any good. Now, there is a simpler method. This is when you're doing research and when you're looking for new articles, that's how you do it properly. Again, I just wanted to show it to you so you're aware of what goes behind the scenes. There's a much easier method of doing all this. It's the next slide. And that is something called UpToDate. Again, this you definitely don't have access to through YU. Hopefully, your physician friends will be able to access these things for you. But basically, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a website which has up-to-date medical information. It is very good. It's what everybody uses in the hospital. And you can Google whatever you search for whatever it is that you need, and you'll get articles describing that information. And what they very often have is they also have a patient information option, not just the physician information. So for someone who's not necessarily familiar with all the medical terms, they explain it very clearly, very plainly, and it's very very useful, very easy to use. When I give Reb Leich a new, when he's searching a new topic, I'm giving him the background information. That's what I give him. I usually give him this information from UpToDate. So then that really leads me to my the theme, the overall question across this topic. It's the next slide. And that is, do the rabbis need to answer questions that are presented to them, or do they need to determine facts before answering questions? I mean, what should the achrayus be with you? What do you do, as you mentioned before, someone comes over to the rabbi, presents him a case, and then you paskin based off that case? Or do you also have a responsibility to go find out that information, some more information yourself, to make sure that what you're answering is, in fact, accurate? So I just decided to give a couple of sources. Next slide as well. just again, there's a Rambam that says, right, you can't have people in the Sanhedrin on a list of things that they have to know. One of them is refuah. They have to know, they have to be familiar with medicine, right? And again, these are, there's a lot of Gemaras that talk about this, how if you're going to Paskin HaShadas with Metzias, you have to, you know, go out and join the shepherds to make sure that you understand what a mum is. There's a lot of, we have at least some sources that support this position. So the question is really, who's the one who's actually going to Paskin this question? And by that I mean we have really two models. I think I'm like three slides ahead of you, potentially. Two models. One of them is a doctor presents facts to the rabbi, and then the rabbi can decide. And the other option is the rabbi presents halacha to the doctor, and the doctor decides. And I have two extreme examples of this in the next slide. So I have one, Rav Aviner apparently wrote somewhere. The question was whether or not you have to, for a swine flu, whether or not you have to get the vaccine for swine flu. Somebody asked him, and he said, "What enzushir al rabbanim? This is not a question for rabbis. This is a question for doctors. Why are you asking me ridiculous questions? Leave me alone." Right? That's one extreme, whereas I'm not necessarily going to hold him responsible for this. You know, I don't think he would answer the same thing if someone asked him whether or not they're allowed to abort their child. I'm sure then he'll have some sort of halachic opinion as well. But here, he's at least advocating this position that, you know what, medical questions belong to doctors, leave the rabbis out of it. My sister's eighth grade rabbi, this is a great story that happened last year, right before I gave this lecture last year, actually. So it was great timing. Her eighth grade rabbi walks into class, and he asks anyone's father's a doctor. So my sister raises her hand. Okay, he goes, "You should just know, if you have any medical question during the week, you're allowed to ask your father. But on Shabbos, you're not allowed to ask your father. You can only ask a rabbi. Only rabbis are allowed to answer medical questions on Shabbos. The doctors are not allowed to be involved at all." So my sister, obviously quite precocious, raises her hand and goes, "But my brother is a rabbi doctor. Can I ask him?" And the response was, "There's no such thing as a rabbi doctor." All right. Anyways, obviously a different extreme. And the problem is that's funny, but it also ends up with really serious cases. And again, some of these things, you hear these stories, you don't necessarily, you know, you think they're myths, you know, some sort of mythology that we like saying about certain people. But I had this case like this. I was doing a rotation, COVID ICU in Israel. And I have a pregnant woman present to the hospital, 35-year-old woman. I think she had like 10 kids. She's pregnant with her, she was pregnant with her 10th kid, right? So I think 35 weeks gestation. She didn't get vaccinated. Her rav told her she's not allowed to get vaccinated. Okay, so no vaccine. She gets COVID. She's at home on oxygen. Situation gets worse. She comes to the hospital. Okay, you're at the hospital. Woman has low O2 sats. We got to get her on a ventilator, and you have to do a C-section or at least induced labor. You have to get the kid out. This woman can't handle it. Calls up the rav. Rav says, "You're not allowed to be put on a ventilator, and you're not allowed to do a C-section." Spent half a day arguing with this couple until finally, the woman couldn't really argue. She couldn't breathe. But her arguing with her husband. Husband finally agrees, and we're finally able to actually provide treatment to this woman. And it's just unbelievable. You can do a C-section and put on a ventilator. This woman, you know, she just got back.
Would she have died otherwise?
She definitely would have died. I mean, we were afraid, yeah, she wasn't going to make it as is. Yeah. She was, it was about 2 weeks where they didn't think she was going to walk out of the ICU. She made it, but again, I remember I was going with the head nurse, transporting her from the ER to the ICU, which, by the way, ICU was just, people were fighting over beds in the ICU, and this woman refused to get a bed, and we're transferring over to the ICU, and the head nurse, as we're passing over, is like, "Miutal lechalutin," like this entire thing was like, there's no reason for this. She just got a stupid vaccine. We could have avoided this whole issue altogether. Okay, beseda. But again, this situations where you're not, you know, people, again, this is extremes, but I'm trying to illustrate a point. I think the ideal model is, I know before I show two different things, but the ideal model is, again, a rabbi has a basic understanding of medicine, at least that part I can control, or I can at least try to help. The other option, though, the other part of it, though, is that a physician has either a basic understanding of halacha, or at the very least, enough of respect that you're able to speak to him, and you're able, or them, and you're able to get the information that you need in order to be able to reach a good, a solid conclusion. And the reason why I think it's particularly important that we have this conversation here in Yeshiva is, next slide, I actually had Rav Willig, usually not all the Yadin Yadin Chaburas are recorded, but this was, so I feel free recording it. But Rav Willig, in the middle of one of his Chaburas, he was talking about our Bezdin. He goes, "Our Bezdin is the best in America, not because we have the biggest Talmidei Chachamim necessarily, but because we get the facts right." You have to know the Metzias. You can't, if you don't know the Metzias, you don't understand what you're talking about, there's nothing else, you're going to get everything else subsequently incorrect. You have to be aware of this information. And so, that leads me to the next slide, which is the ideal in practice. I doubt anyone can read this, but hopefully when you get the PowerPoint, you'll actually be able to see it. But this is the response that apparently someone asked Reb Bleich after that article in Hamudia got published. Can you get the HPV vaccine? And so he wrote this response. And again, we can't see it, but throughout this response, he's quoting scientific journals, quoting the literature, and describing how that will affect halacha and how obviously you should get the HPV vaccine, A, it's definitely not usher, and B, that you should do it. And then this is, again, the ideal conversation between physicians and rabbanim provides good, excellent results. And so I think I'd like to at least conclude. I managed to make it in under an hour. At least conclude in the next slide that there is a, I think there's a beyond the ideal. It's great that, you know, we're having a conversation here, but beyond the ideal is, you know, why you mismachim are probably some of the most educated rabbanim in the world, right? In addition to, obviously, from obviously our learning, but I mean also by the fact that most of us have college educations and have studied and understand things and are able to at least have elementary concept of a lot of these issues, we're able to, we're in the position to be able to provide very good medical information. And we have access to a lot of medical specialists because of who our kehilas are, who our balabatim are. And so I think that ideally, from here, we should hopefully, I mean, the ideal situation is we have a group of dedicated rabbanim dealing with these issues that have relationships with physicians and are able to serve as a platform for everybody else that has these questions. They know who to turn to. Anyway, I think that's basically my presentation. Next week, we're going to speak. I know we're going to do medical terminology. I try to do a full PowerPoint on medical terminology. I think it's way too long. So we're probably just going to get through at least some beginning of life issues, probably a lot of contraceptives.
Would you be able to, I mean, if you're comfortable doing that, share the list with me beforehand, so maybe, you know, just make sure that, you know, that we're...